心思。I never thought a bunch of cows would make it. I want to know. You know. These ads to run on Channel 56 were prepared, and I'm sure Mr. Cal Brack is frustrated because he's been waiting to get these ads to play on Channel 56. But at least I'm playing them to open the program instead of that old opening that has line going around the globe. And you listen on satellite, so that's what that was. That's an ad that was prepared to play on 56. And I may be persuaded again to play the program that that was cut from, of what those silly cows were doing that made me laugh like that. I'd forgotten, but people in here hadn't. And then we played it one day, and I found myself laughing the same way again. If it gets boring here tonight, I'll pull that out. But I have a lot of teaching to do tonight. 2 hours from now, the program will play from the service this morning. And I hinted at a lot of doctrinal controversies that shaped the Church of the West and produced a broad ignorance on the part of most Protestants and most Christians in the West of the heritage and rich part that churches of the East played in the early centuries of developing the church, clear up to the 11th century. As I said this morning in the message, Protestantism is just a branch off the tree of Catholicism. And about the 5th and 6th century, many of the Middle Eastern churches that provided the original basis, they were first called Christians at Antioch. The church, the Syriac church, was the first Gentile church outside of Jerusalem and produced the first church council recorded in the book of Acts. Paul records he spent his first 3.5 years after his conversion on the Damascus Road in Arabia and then Damascus, both Middle Eastern. The king of Edessa converted early on. And we're vastly ignorant of those Middle Eastern churches that were excommunicated and cut off in the 5th and 6th centuries, and the vast Eastern Orthodoxy, Russian, Greek, others, cut off by the church at Rome in the 11th century. And yet these were the earliest languages into which the New Testament and the Old Testament for use were translated into, and the Western Church is vastly ignorant of our heritage in the Ethiopic language, the Syriac language, all three of its dialects, the Coptic language, the two most prominent, the Bohoric and the Sahidic, translations into Arabic. And I made some brief references to the church councils that cut these people off. So I'd like to do a little bit of review on the early history of the church tonight. But next Sunday is a big day coming up. It starts I have a birthday month. I mean, I like birthdays. So I stretch them into a month. And I got married on the day before my birthday. So the anniversary is easy to remember. And next Sunday starts at least birthday week. And my wife has asked me to let her surprise me with a few things. She knows I don't like surprises, but I'm hard to surprise. But I said, yes, I've learned to trust her that much. I don't trust the rest of you that much. Better not try to surprise me. So I'll be surprised, as well as you. It's not your regular service. It's going to be a celebration. Two buses last time I heard are coming from Las Vegas. People are coming from San Francisco, coming from all over the country. You're probably a little bit suffering in the mental capacities if you don't, you that are congregants, if you don't come there next Sunday. It's a special day, only comes once a year. And I want to give you at least one or two songs to make reservations for next Sunday. But then I want to dig into the teaching, which is preparation for the message that will come up as we replay this morning service from the start, a little after 9:30 California time on Channel 56 and across the network and around the world. Before we went live to the satellite listeners and the shortwave listeners and the internet listeners and people around the world, we were playing a festival of some years ago in which I was rejoicing that this teaching could go around the world by shortwave. Next Sunday, in a series of satellites, we're covering the world by shortwave, but we're talking about satellites like what we cover here in the United States, the KU band off Telstar and GE3 transponder 20. Of course, the internet covers the world. But we are going on a string of satellites across Europe and across the Middle East and across Asia, starting with London time, 7:30 next Sunday morning, 11:30 Saturday night, our time. 7:30 London time. We'll be playing the service, obviously, as we play for the Sunday morning plays across the United States. We will be playing a one-hour program, which is the message from the cathedral with the song before and the song after, hitting London at 7:30 and at the same time, but with the staggered time changes by relays from satellite to satellite. When it comes 7:30 in the morning in India and Pakistan, we will be hitting them at that time across Europe, France, North Africa, Middle East, through Greece, India, Pakistan, a series of satellites, not just sound shortwave, picture in sound from the cathedral. You'll know what's hitting around the world if you tune in at 11:30 Saturday night off satellite. That's what we'll be hitting just before we join Las Vegas at 12:30 on Saturday night. That hour from 11:30 to 12:30 will be sent by multiple satellites around the world as we still step forward in faith. Come to celebrate with us next Sunday at the Cathedral between 9th and Olympic on Broadway. And make your reservations now. Get them in by Wednesday noon so we can mail you the passes. Get on the telephone. I'm not sure that you heard me when I said, we're live, by the way, if you're watching on 56 or anywhere in the world, listening or watching. You can pick us up 24 hours a day on internet. Go to our homepage, drgenescott.com, and there's three or four entry boxes you check. And if you're an internet surfer and are hooked up to any one of the access windows, you can pick us up. In addition to the homepage data, you can pick up the program that's coming off satellite 24 hours a day. Sound and picture. Of course, shortwave, you can pick us up on multiple frequencies on every square inch of the globe. But this is a big leap of expansion. To be Sunday morning at a prime 7:30 a.m. time, coordinated as the satellites are strung across Europe and Asia, coordinated to relay from satellite to satellite to hit each time zone from London to Pakistan and all of India, North Africa, Europe and the Middle East at 7:30 a.m. every Sunday morning. That means we'll be heralding this message through Romans around the world, and they're struggling quickly to coordinate the rest of the distance across China. We keep moving on, folks. I saw in the earlier program that Fountain of Faith, and though we already cover the globe, every square inch of it, 24 hours a day, with these other mediums, Sunday morning's the traditional time that people tune in, and straight, strict Bible teaching, the message, an opening song and closing song from the cathedral, edited into a tight hour, will begin playing this coming Sunday, the 10th of August, at 7:30 in the morning, their time, all across Europe and into Asia, as far as India and Pakistan. I think that's a wonderful happening to celebrate. You know, when I was the research director of the Committee on Advance, the Blue Ribbon Committee, in the early 1970s, late 60s and early 70s, that reorganized the General Council of the Assemblies of God. Tom Zimmerman, the superintendent, with whom I was very close, because as I've told you, I was instrumental to save the faith of his boy, who was doing a PhD in clinical psychology and was losing his faith. Tom and I became very close. And of course, he had a dream of establishing an international Assemblies of God, and he was sending me to speak at conventions in various places. And one of the things that he said to me, he said, among the charismatics and Pentecostals in America, in those days, I was the first PhD ever to come out of the Assemblies of God growing up in the church, my dad pastoring for 30 years in Oroville. I subsequently went independent by choice. Thank God he's given me the position that I have this free voice around the world, but Tom and I remain very close. In fact, when I was elected pastor here, he called crying on the phone and said, "Gene, we just passed 10,000 churches." And I'm calling because I know who to thank for the roadmap that was laid out from the Committee on Advance. And, of course, he asked me if I would bring the church back into the Assemblies of God. And I said, no, I've got to be free to pursue God's Word. But when he was sending me, he said, you know, the charismatics and the Pentecostals here, and as I said, I was the first PhD. I took a part-time professorship at Evangelical College, their first college, teaching 16 units, and they rearranged the schedule so I could teach Tuesday and Wednesday and still fly out to my other activities to help them get their accreditation. J. Robert Ashcroft, the father of our present Attorney General, was the president. He and I were dear friends. But he said, Gene, the charismatics and Pentecostals look suspicious on education. And somehow alien to spirituality. Not so with the Europeans. There they have respect for scholarship and for education. Now, these many years later, knowing that there's, in many areas of the world, a negative attitude toward American television evangelists, particularly because of the money solicitation. We don't solicit any money. We just teach. Don't want anybody giving any money until they're first taught, and then the giving is a response based on the way they value the teaching. Thus it becomes worship or worship. But after these many years, to hit the Sunday morning European, Middle Eastern, and Asian audience with nothing but teaching. And perhaps you will understand why, with the international audience we have, I haven't yet come to the point, I will probably 2-3 Sundays from now, somewhere during these 5 verses of the 21st to the 26th verse, to the almost unanimous bad translation of the German, the French, the Italian, the Spanish, the other translations, who have succumbed to the same kind of attitude that has produced the Revised Standard, the American Standard, the newer Revised Versions, that want to reduce the saving power of the gospel down to what we do, simply believing in Jesus. Not everybody in the world reads the King James. Well, that may be worth to you. And as I said, most of the Western evangelists, if they even look at the languages of Syriac or Middle Eastern languages of any kind, it's so they can go and convert them. I mean, the tragedy of American unlearned, reasonably intelligent but unlearned preachers that dominate the television scene, is there an insult to much of the world who views Russian Orthodoxy, Greek Orthodoxy, remember in the Lebanese War, we heard a lot about Maronite Christians, which are a Catholic conclave that represent about 30% of the Christians in Lebanon, and from which the president of the country until recent years always came forth. The rich heritage of the Syriac Church, the Nestorians, the church that claims its founding from Thomas in India, all these vast hundreds of millions of Christians in Eastern Orthodoxy, and what were communal faith, considered to be that in the earliest councils, members of the Church of Jesus Christ at large, are viewed by Catholics. I have my quarrel with some of the Catholic doctrines and with the institution, but not with Catholic people. And I'm a preacher of faith. And I'm a teacher of faith. I'm not going into these places to convert the Maronite Christians, the Catholics of the world. I'm going with mutual respect for their honesty of commitment and the realization that most of the Christians of the Middle East, particularly those of Aramaic and Syriac connection, have grown up believing the Bible was written first in their language and not hearing until they encountered the West that it was written in Greek. God has opened a wonderful door. This is the age of television. The third world listens to shortwave. But across Europe and the sophisticated cities in a place like India, intelligent, educated people need to understand you don't have to park your brain at the door of a church to be a Christian, and need to hear the gospel presented with respect for the rich contributions their culture and language made to the faith that we have. I believe it's the time. It's wonderful that on my 74th birthday, we're taking another mountain around the world. So get on the phone and come to the cathedral and celebrate with us next Sunday. Get on the telephone. My wife just came down from the director's booth and told me that we've lost the character generator, which puts phone number and name and all the various lettering on the screen. Now, I don't see it on shortwave, but it's a necessary part of the live programming. And these are the ways you find out we're live. As I sort of enjoy saying, I originated reality TV in this town years ago. Now, the danger, she tells me, is that they may be able to restore it by simply unplugging it and plugging it back in. And we have an engineer on retainer that thinks I'm stupid, I guess. So I'm telling my wife, if he doesn't get his ass down here and fix this problem that he created and he's monkeyed around with the last 3 weeks, fire him. You can say I said that publicly, so that he doesn't blame her. Do you all know the degree to which I hate engineers?
Yes, sir.
Worse than women.
Yes, sir.
And me, I'm telling you, that's something. I hate engineers. I tell all the women in my church, don't marry one. They'll put meters on the bedpost and tell you that things are happening to you because the meter says it is, that isn't happening to you. They're just graduated tinker toy babies. To think they're a genius because they learned how to hook up a couple of wires. I am able to do that without electrical tools. That'll hit you sometime tomorrow. I don't have to understand what they're doing. But when I pay money and sign the check, I expect them to get it done.
Yes,
and I don't bow at their shrine of self-deification. They're just hirelings. Just whores, but they better perform. Now we risk going black for 2 seconds. I said, I'll walk us into it. And if we go black for longer than 2 seconds, expect an engineer to be buried. We pay him $3,000 a month on retainer. I have attorneys that went to school much longer that think they're more important. And when I say come, they come. Now it's time for my voice to be heard, and I sure hope he's listening. I don't want to hear any excuses. I want him to get on a plane, get his ass down here and fix this problem or forget about ever doing anything with us again. And if there's any television engineers out there that have any decency in you that really believes that you can demonstrate you're not a freak show like most engineers who understands the value of money, and when you make a deal, you will keep your word to your own hurt, and you will get in here hat in hand, and for money, not ego massage, for money. I like whores better than engineers. They know what the deal is. They have character. They don't think they're doing you a favor. You say, how do you know those things? Well, ask Paul how he knew so much about what went on in Corinth. I'm 74 years old, and I've been talked to by a lot of people. I understand and admire that principle. Thanks be to God, never had to utilize that source of pleasure. Why pay for what abounds freely? Get the milk free, don't buy the cow. But engineers are not free. So I want one that understands the principle of the street. You're paid. Don't expect your ego to be massaged. Don't come in like King Kong. Don't enter this place and try to bring my employees into your wing. Keep your mouth shut. Do your job. And when we call you, you're working for me or my wife. And get on your horse and get your ass here and do the job and quit giving me what I really want to say, BS. If there is a man or a woman out there in this audience that likes money and is an engineer that has the brains to understand you're a tinker toy whore that's being paid, and you will move your instruments to get the job done, give me a call. But that's too sophisticated a language for an engineer to understand. Anybody that knows any engineers, they just want to be paid to do a job. Don't even think about becoming a Christian. I don't want you as a member of my church. Because when you get out of line, I really want to let you understand some language that you maybe haven't heard. I gave it to this guy just once. It took him 3 days to recover. And he's had my wife's gentle treatment ever since. Now this has affected me. Now, there's got to be a television engineer somewhere that's listening a few stations I'm on. One of you guys down at that station. Call your boss and tell him you're going to moonlight. Character generators can be bought. Character generators can be installed. Character generators can be fixed. We had this problem for at least a month now. Well, I'm going to fix it. I got this on order. There is nothing that makes this preacher matter. You can just about do anything to me. Don't insult my intelligence. That I don't sit silent for. I don't suffer fools. But now, having cathartic that out so you would know this is live, and Gene Scott hasn't changed. I haven't changed a bit in 29 years. In fact, I wouldn't mind punching one of them out. It'd be sort of an honor to be arrested for assault and battery. This 74-year-old man beating the crap out of some 40-year-old yuppie engineer. I'll bet my church would bail me out. Now, pull that plug. And let's see if we go black for longer than 2 seconds or 2 minutes. Let's have it. You know what's coming, folks? This is live. Maybe while we're black, can somebody find an engineer I can practice on? Pull the plug. Well, I came too sooner than the engineer would. We okay? My wife said, fine. You got your orders. Fire this guy if he doesn't get his ass down here and does his job.
Yes, sir.
That's the kind of wife all of you should know. It's always when we need somebody. We can keep somebody on retainer for years, keep them in a job that we don't need until, because we recognize a talent that one day we'll need. Then the day we need it, they go bananas. I never had a truck driver I hired. He's worthless for anything else. I'd pay him for months to be nothing but an irritant. Until the week we needed and knew we were going to need to make a long haul with a truck, and then he would just go insane that week. Till I'd have to suspend him or sit him down and we couldn't use his talent and still have to go buy some talent somewhere else to move the truck. Now, this guy's been a problem, all mouth and no performance. And I talked to you, you're back, Melissa, I talked to you about next Sunday and I cautioned you. I said, don't fire him before next Sunday because it's a big Sunday and things can go wrong. I never compromise and you've learned never to compromise and you didn't before came here. So go get him on the phone and tell him, if you don't get this thing fixed for next Sunday, just goodbye. And don't send him any more checks until he gets down here and does his job.
Yes, sir.
So we're live. Now, she's coming to tell me how much she loves me, so I need some music so she can do that. Get on the telephone. Now, I said, we pay him $3,000 a month to be available. Then when we call on him, he charges his rate and his time and his expenses and his parts and all the other stuff. There's got to be an engineer somewhere that wants to perform for Mooney. It's that simple. Some little tin god coming in here, and they always do this to you. They get things half done and leave. So they think they hold you captive because they have to come back, and they never have the decency when you fire them to say, well, I got this thing half done, I'll come and finish it. Now, maybe somewhere in this world there's an engineer that likes money and has some decency and honor to do a job. Very few people in this generation have a work ethic. Very few. I sit and watch them at a hotel I go to often. No work ethic. No wonder that green card people are doing the work of America today. You know, we even got soldiers that think it's awful that they have to be risk dying. They didn't join the army to fight. They didn't join the army to risk getting killed. They joined the army to get a scholarship and move their family on the base. Well, you stupid fool, what'd you join the army for? That's what it's about. Well, I don't see any honor in this. I mean, I disagree with where I'm being sent. What did you join the army for? You got fish scales for brains? Now, I just got told they got to go black another 2 seconds to plug it back in now. You know, the picture is affected when they unplug this thing. Now they got to plug it back in. We don't know if it's fixed yet. So here we go. Go black one more time. Well, now if it's fixed, put my name on the screen. Or do something, a phone number on the screen. Then I'll believe it. Now, 15 or 20... 30 minutes ago, I said I wanted to teach. Now it's almost, the hour is almost upon us. But we got another hour and some minutes, so I will still teach. But right now, Since we're getting close to the spinover station break time, I've got 12 minutes for you to call and make your reservations. Then I'll bear down with the teaching. Get on the telephone. Highland Park, California. I'd like you to know your whiskers are rubbing on the microphone. It's coming out over the air. At first I couldn't figure out what it was, then I figured it out. May I have a pass for three adults? Yes, but you're too late on the whiskers bit. My wife already picked up on it, and the cameraman told me, and I lowered the microphone, and then announced that my wife's going to have to trim my beard and cut my hair before next Sunday. She does everything else well, so why not? That too. It keeps us close. But thank you for recognizing that my beard had gotten too long. But it's been handled. I'm here from West L.A. Pastor, I appreciate all the time and effort you put into the message each week. You know, that's nice. And I've gotten several calls like that today. It's like some of you just woke up. Yeah, I put a lot of effort in. Made possible because my wife's doing everything else. And yes, I put a lot of effort into the message, and I'm glad that you are aware of that. God has to do the rest, and the other voice has to kick in. But I do my part before I get there. Someone else called. Oh, this one said I'll be bringing $74 for birthday offering. That's one of the good things about that sort of a tradition around here. One of the good things about getting older. Why don't you handle it like I do my bike ride? I ride my bike my age, but my wife said, well, why don't you add our anniversary to it? So it goes up. I mean, let's say, see, when I'm 80, I'll have to ride 89 miles. Because it'll be the 9th anniversary if I'm counting real quick. So last year she added 2 miles, so we rode my birthday number and the anniversary. This year we have to add 3 miles, making it 77. So you're $3 short. Get on the telephone. Washington, D.C. amazes me. And thank you, we had a good, not enough, but a good contingent of voices of faith at 2:30 this morning here in California. At 5:30 in Washington, D.C. But the calls from Washington, D.C. every week outnumber any of the other stations that were on, from San Francisco to Dallas to Nashville. Washington, D.C. And here from Maryland is someone that watched me years ago, watching on Channel 5 and attended one of our banquets in Washington, D.C. in those old days when I was on Channel 66 in a suburb of Washington. I like this. You're getting better as you get older. I met you at the Waldorf. I won't forgive you for making me lose all my sleep. In those days, we were on all night on Channel 66. I had moved back from Jamaica recently. It's so good to see you again. But a stack of calls from Washington, D.C. this morning. We need voices of faith every week from 2:30 on Sunday morning to receive the calls from the cities on the East Coast and the Midwest and the South that are now receiving this on Sunday morning. So, voices of faith, stay faithful. You got 3 minutes until we go into the next hour, and I'm going to start teaching. So, make your reservations for next Sunday during the next song. Well, I can't resist reading some of the responses to the previous hour. Palmdale. Before I found the love of my life, I dated an engineer for 2 years. You are right, sir. He was all talk and no action. Here's Lakewood. Sir, I had the weirdest image of two engineers, male and female, having a sexual encounter, and the gauges and meters were producing only static. More seriously, Los Alamitos. Reservation to Ren for birthday Sunday. Thank you for the great message. I taped one of the first messages you taught on the Ethiopic, converted it into a European videotape, and sent it to the grandson of the Emperor of Ethiopia. I plan on recording the message from today and send it to him also. Oh, here's a brave man. Reservations. Leaving my phone number for Doc. The hours he can be reached. My name is, and he gives it to me, I'm an engineer. Well, there ought to be some more. Now, no more calls. You know, a lot of people do not know what went on in the first centuries after Constantine conquered the Eastern Emperor, united the Roman Empire, converted to Christianity before that act, and thus the reign of Constantinople, 4th century. Now you've got to understand, the United States is just had his 200th birthday. 3rd century is that period between 200 and 300. 1st century took us to 100 A.D. 2nd century took us to 200 A.D., the age of the United States. Think of what's happened in these last 200 years. And into the 3rd century, the persecution, terrible persecution, under the Roman Empire and their reign of terror when the emperor was worshipped as God. Much of which, by the way, bypassed the fringes of some of the Christian groups that their translations remained intact. Manuscripts were seized in the Roman Empire and burned, along with the Christians. 300 years have passed. 320-some. Constantine becomes the emperor, Christianizes the empire, and then the fights broke out. When they quit being martyred, they had nothing left to do but fight with each other. We're digging back behind these councils to the earliest scripture from the time of Paul's writing. As a Roman citizen, no less, which saved him from the punishment that was to be meted out in Jerusalem. We're digging back behind. And I thought it'd be nice to refresh you a little bit. The reign of Constantine, I'm reading from Sheldon's History of the Christian Church, his first volume. The reign of Constantine inaugurated almost of necessity an era of theological activity, if not of theological strife. That the church, when relieved of the strong outward pressure, should apply itself with great zeal to the deeper problems of the faith was a very natural turn of events. Now, you're going to hear, if you just hang on through these first sentences, some real religious Donnybrooks. Where there's mental life, there's always speculation in some department or other, always philosophizing, always endeavors after the exact definition, the satisfactory defense of truth. And in the centuries following Constantine, philosophizing was drawn by an irresistible attraction to the theological field. And did they start fighting? From out of a variety of things discussed by this historian, from all these causes resulted an age intensely polemical. As many testimonies and incidents assure us, controversial zeal burned with indescribable ardor. Disputes and contentions, wrote Theodoret, arose in every city and every village concerning theological dogmas. These were indeed melancholy scenes over which tears might have been shed. For it was not as in bygone ages, when the church was attacked with strangers and enemies, they who fought against each other in this strife of tongues were members of each other and belonged to the one body. Everything in the city, says Gregory of Nyssa, speaking of the Arian controversy in Constantinople that brought on the council at Nicaea, called by Constantine, and which gave the Nicene Creed that has steered the Western churches particularly these many years, the Trinitarian controversy. Gregory says, speaking of the Arian controversy in Constantinople, everything in the city is full of such, as dogmatizing over things incomprehensible. The lanes, the markets, the avenues, the streets, the clothiers, the bankers, the dealers in provisions. When you ask one how much a thing costs, he will favor you with a discourse about the begotten and the unbegotten. When you inquire the price of bread, he replies, the Father is greater than the Son, and the Son is subordinate. If you ask, is the bath ready, he declares the Son was created from nothing. S-O-N, not S-U-N. I know not by what name, whether frenzy or madness or other kindred terms, this evil which has come upon the people may fitly be called. This is but a prelude to the councils that begin to separate the Middle Eastern and Eastern churches from the faith as a creed. In like manner, Gregory Nazianzen testifies, has gone so far that the whole market resounds with the discourses of heretics. Every banquet is corrupted with this babbling even to nausea. Every merrymaking is transformed into a mourning, and every funeral solemnity is almost alleviated with this brawling as a still greater evil. Even the chambers of women, the nurseries of simplicity, are disturbed thereby. And the flowers of modesty are crushed by this precocious practice of dispute. If such language applies to the doctrinal strifes of the 4th century, what shall describe the polemic zeal of the 5th century? Said Nestorius in his inaugural sermon at Constantinople, "Give me, O Emperor, the earth purified from heretics, and I will give you heaven in return. Help me to destroy the heretics, and I will help you to conquer the Persians." But intolerant as was the zeal which these words reveal, it by no means exceeded that which was directed against Nestorius himself, as he fell under the suspicion of heresy, Nestorius I mentioned in the message this morning. At the Council of Ephesus in 431, oft called the Council of Robbers, a whole string of anathemas was hurled against him. You think preachers fight today? One bishop remarked that as those who counterfeit the imperial coins are deserving of the severest penalties, so Nestorius, who has dared to falsify the Orthodox faith, was deserving of all punishments at the hand of God and men. Another declared that Nestorius was worse than Cain and the Sodomites, and that the earth might fitly open to swallow him up, or fire from heaven descend upon him. In the official notification, notice, he was the bishop at Constantinople. And in his inaugural sermon, he wanted the emperor to help him destroy heretics. Now, they're shooting at him. In the official am I boring you?
Yes, sir.
In the official notification of the council of his condemnation, Nestorius was named a new Judas. I guess I come off pretty good. All they do is complain about me smoking a cigar. Man, I'm feeling better all the time. I don't like this thing. You still smoking that cigar? Hope she's listening. And I went with my heart open. It was obvious. And she thought I was not worse than Cain or the Sodomites because I smoked a cigar. In the official notification of the council of his condemnation, Nestorius was named a new Judas. Now, I want you to understand that this is what the church became by the 3rd century, into the 2nd, into the 3rd century. This is what the church became. And it was this same series of councils. I got a book here I'll dig into tonight. The first 7 ecumenical councils, when the church still considered itself whole before the trend toward the West. I want to tell you something. In those first 3 centuries, the Western, the European side of the Roman Empire was persecuting, killing, and destroying the Christians and overrun by barbarians as the empire itself moved to Constantinople, which was the seat of learning. And it wasn't until Constantinople fell that manuscripts moved to the West that produced both the Reformation and the Renaissance. And the ignorant priests of the West accused them of corrupting God's Word with heathen languages like Hebrew and Greek. This is why I'm digging back behind the 3rd century. And how could they have these councils without scriptures? And these councils are held in the Middle East. And then the power began to move west. But already by the 3rd century, Nestorius was named a new Judas, and the city of Ephesus expressed its delight over the sentence by processions, torches, and illuminations. You ever hear the name Eusebius, the father of church history? Eusebius of Caesarea? He's going to be temporarily excommunicated before the Council of Nicaea. I thought I'd say that. A layman and a lawyer writing subsequently named Nestorius, quote, "That God-assaulting tongue, that second conclave of Caiaphas, that workshop of blasphemy, Cyril of Alexandria, crooked briber of politicians at the summer palace of the emperor at the council of Ephesus seeking to get his will, Cyril of Alexandria, who was the soul of the crusade against Nestorius, scrupled at no means for securing his end, even to the bribing of numerous court officials. The letters of his archdeacon show conclusively that he made presents to various parties at the court and exhorted the church at Constantinople to be careful to do their part in satisfying the avarice of certain persons." Appley attempts, indeed, writing about it, to soften the practice of Cyril on the plea that it was an Oriental custom to introduce a negation with a sovereign or other dignitaries with presents. No doubt in opening communication with a distant and comparatively unknown court, Oriental courtesy emphasized the propriety of making some gift, but who imagines that the custom of that day made it incumbent upon Cyril, Bishop of Alexandria in Egypt, to accompany with a multitude of presents his approach to his own government at Constantinople, with which he had already been in close communication. Judged by the nature and intent of the transactions, it was a gross case of bribery. Oh, these were godly men led of the Lord, making decisions that must bind the church and declare heretics who disagree thereafter. This is why I'm so glad I'm free. So glad that I don't have to worry about peer pressure. I guess the only peer I worry about is God, and Paul's listening in. I want to dig out what he said. Then you do what you want with it. All that can be said is that the conscience of the time was not fully up to the modern standard in his judgment of such practices, but with such unscrupulous and relentless ardor, Cyril scarcely represents the extreme of controversial heat. His successor, Dioscorus, surpassed him. The Council of Ephesus in 449 was ruled by him, and his cohort of monks, with all the arts of terrorism which might have been chosen by a military dictator. Flavian, the venerable patriarch of Constantinople, was set upon with such atrocity that he soon died from his injuries. Godly men seeking the will of God for their creedal announcements at these councils. The most Protestants who have never read anything about a church council think that we have to accept all of their conclusions. The Reformation was supposed to take us back behind the councils to the pure Word of God, New Testament time. That's why I'm digging to the Word, past this surface of obscurity. Any opinion counter to the sentiment of the dominant party was greeted with a furious anathema. Cast into hell, verbally. As words implying two natures in Christ were quoted from Eusebius at Dorylaeum, a chorus of voices shouted, "Burn him alive!" As he has divided Christ, so let him be divided. In the rage for dogma, conduct was completely ignored. Charges of adultery and other crimes being brought against a bishop, Dioscorus answered, "If you have any accusation to prefer against the man's orthodoxy, we will receive charges." If you have any accusations to indicate that he is departing from the doctrine of the Baptist Church, or the Assemblies of God. I think it's kind of funny. A few years ago, the Assemblies of God sold its mailing list or rented it to a travel agent guy down in Texas. He used to work with Dr. Craig Lamb, so he could send a special mailing to all their mailing lists. And all of them went out, every single, to all the different addresses in the United States, to some church address, which was, in every case, abbreviated, the Ass of God. The first Ass of God. If you have any accusation to prefer against a man's orthodoxy, whether he's a good Methodist or not, or Pentecostal Church of God, or Church of the Nazarene, or Church of God, Cleveland, Tennessee, we will receive charges, but we have not come here to pass sentence for adultery. Even the honored and important Council of Chalcedon often became a babble of anathema stigmatizing voices. Violent invectives were liberally hurled. As the council made place for Theodoret, the party of Dioscorus cried out, "Cast out the Jew, the enemy of God." To this, the friends of Theodoret responded with the exclamation, "Cast out the disturber, cast out the murderer." The Fifth Ecumenical Council, held at Constantinople in 553, was not content with condemning merely living heretics, resorting to ex post facto decrees. It anathematized on the score of doctrines not authoritatively settled in his day, Theodore of Mopsuestia, a man who had died long before in unquestioned fellowship with the church. So they're excommunicating and anathematizing the dead. The West, as a general thing, did not proceed to quite the same extremes as the East in this controversial era. Jerome, however, the venerable producer of the Vulgate. Don't you like gossip? This is ex post facto gossip. Jerome, however, did not fall much below the Eastern standard. He stigmatized the opinions of Jovinian as the, quote, kissings of the old serpent, and named him, though a monk, an Epicurus because he opposed the current overvaluation of monasticism. Vigilantius, another one of his contemporaries, he said that he might more properly be called Dormitantius, and intimated that his presence in Gaul had supplied a full compensation for the lack of mythological monsters in that country. That's Jerome. A still more signal exhibition of controversial rancor appears in his reference to Rufinus. At a time when the grave invited to charity, he wrote, "The scorpion is buried under the soil of Sicily with Enceladus and Porphyrion. The many-headed Hydra has ceased to hiss against us." According to the Arian view, Christ was to be esteemed neither truly divine nor truly human, neither God nor man, but being intermediate between the two, the first and most exalted of creatures, who at the fullness of time assumed a human body for the sake of man's redemption. Such a view as this had never been received in the church with any favor, and indeed an exact parallel is not found among the preceding heresies. Arius, who gave the name to this heresy, was a native of Libya, but came to reside at Alexandria as a presbyter of the church there, four to the west in Libya, east to Alexandria. He is described as tall and thin, aesthetic in habit, and possessed of considerable tact as a logician. About the year 320, his peculiar views had attracted sufficient attention to cause the summation or summing of a council of Egyptian and Libyan bishops by which he and his followers were excommunicated in that area. But Arius was not to be silenced. And I will pick that up from this other book in the next half hour. I'll give you a little dose of what is coming. There's a very colorful guy here that will amaze you. If I can find the page quickly, I'll give you a little bit of a taste of what's coming. Of course, you know, Origen, one of the fathers that we have the Hexapla from, his solution to urges for sin was to castrate himself. So he became the ultimate expression of putting the flesh down. He was a important, important early church father. But I got something here that's even better. Now, I think I can find it by the time the song is finished. You make your reservations when the song is finished. I'll shut the phones off again, and I want to tell you about this guy. Go on telephone. Oh, I'm going to give you another song, because too many are on the phone. Come on, call, make your reservation. Call about anything. I don't care. If it's bad news, we'll throw it in the wastebasket. If it's good news, I will read it. So get on telephone. All right. No more calls. No more calls. Drank the back of my mouth. And a leaky cigar. Oh, here's nice. Manhattan Beach says, thank you, Dr. Scott, for the time on Channel 56. My 4-year-old daughter wants to thank Dr. Scott for the trip today to the butterfly exhibit. I once advertised, send your kids to the real Sunday school, because the pastor, that's me, at the cathedral, the kids from 2 to 12, we take them with adult supervision and air-conditioned bus to one of the many museums in the area for 2 hours of education. I got a call, I think, or a letter this past week from a kid that is thanking me for taking them to see the particular exhibit, the Mayan exhibit, and how he's been getting higher grades in his class and knows more than what they're trying to teach him in the class about the subject from going to the museums. Today they went to a butterfly exhibit. And my 4-year-old daughter wants to thank Doc Scott for the trip today to the butterfly exhibit. Another girl called and said the best thing that happened was the butterfly that landed on her hair. Sherman Oaks, I'm calling to reserve seats for next Sunday. I've watched for years, but I've never been there. You can bring kids, huh? The voice of faith said I told her about the museum trips, and she reserved for 4 adults and 2 children. To tell you, I appreciate your honesty over the years. I really do. Thank you. Canoga Park, you remind me a lot about C.S. Spurgeon. You impressed me. Well, he smoked a cigar. Now, this is news to me about Channel 25. It used to be Channel 38. Thank you for being on Channel 25. I do not have cable, and I'm able to get it loud and clear each night. You're a blessing to the Latino community. I believe you're the only English broadcaster on this station, and the only one with the truth. Little birthday compliment. I'm 43 years old, and I wish I was in half as good a shape as you are. Get on your bike. Thank you for the distilled, pure distilled word you're sending out to us. And thanking you for teaching us without ka-ga-ga. Well, I'll tell you about this person. One of the early, and again, I'm wanting you to understand why I'm digging back beyond. I mean, the Protestants say, well, we go back to the Word. And then they're stuck with the Word. You think these people that have been doing the kinds of things we described wouldn't, in their position of power, twist the Word to support their doctrinal position if they could? That's why I'm digging back behind the manuscripts that are more recent. Here was a view. I could go back earlier, and I will. But I wanted to tell you about this guy that really, this lady that didn't like my cigar, she ran into this guy. And I found the place, and then I lost it again. So I guess I'll have to look some more and just go back and wait until I get to it. And this was quite a character. Oh, here he is. But I'd rather start at the beginning anyway. When proclaimed emperor in 306 by the legions at York in Britain in succession to his father Constantius Chlorus, he was like his father, a solar syncretist worshipping a solar divinity under the name of Apollo. This is Constantine. His religious outlook gradually gave way to a philosophic monotheism and reverence for the divine spirit by whom the universe was governed and whose symbol was the sun, S-U-N. But even at this stage, he must have known of Christianity, certainly. Certainly. His father had not implemented the persecution of Christians in those parts of the empire under his jurisdiction, and one of his sisters bore the Christian name of Anastasia, Resurrection. As Constantine moved toward the decisive battle at the Milvian Bridge outside of Rome, which would give him control of the West, he underwent some sort of religious experience. His biographers speak of his seeing a cross in the sky and a subsequent dream explaining that under this sign he would conquer, whereupon he put a Christian emblem on his legion shields, and conquer he did. Then in 313, he and his co-emperor in the East, Licinius, proclaim religious toleration throughout the empire. Now there's some colorful stuff in early church history. I don't know why Hollywood misses some of this. Prior to Constantine, the beginning of his move back with his father and ultimate becoming the emperor, and then starting the process after the religious experience to conquering the emperor of the East and then ruling the entire Roman Empire with a Christian faith. In 305 earlier, Diocletian, who had been in ill health, resigned along with his co-Augustus of the West, Maximian, as Constantius Chlorus, the father of Constantine, became new Augustus of the West. He asked Galerius, new Augustus of the East at Constantinople, to send him his son, Constantine. That is, Constantius Chlorus had sent his son there. Now about 20, Constantine was the son of Helena, ex-barmaid wife of Constantine, or Constantius Chlorus, and by the way, British, and connected to the roots of Joseph of Arimathea's conversion of the Silurian kingdom. And Helena became the one so enamored with opening up the Holy Land that really brought the preservation of the Holy Land sites and artifacts into prominence. Constantine was the son of Helena, of British heritage, ex-barmaid wife. The British were drinkers in those days. Of Constantius Chlorus, who had divorced her in 293. For the last 12 years, he had been living in Diocletian's court, ostensibly pursuing his education, but actually as a hostage for his father's good conduct. Galerius agreed, but the next day changed his mind and attempted to halt Constantine's journey to the west, but Constantine moved fast, disabling the horses at each imperial posting station until they didn't have any fresh horses to pursue him. He joined his father in northern Gaul and accompanied Constantius to Britain to campaign against the Picts. And in 306, at his father's death at York, he was acclaimed Augustus by the legions. And that was the background to him then conquering and moving westward all the way until conquering the East, he became the sole ruler, emperor of Rome. And the post-apostolic church emerged from the Jewish world. First Council, as you well know, was an argument about whether the Torah, the law, works, still had to be kept by the Christians. Jesus accepted as Messiah, grafted on to the Jewish faith and believing in Jesus as Messiah was the part that Christianity contributed. James, the so-called brother of Jesus, appointed to his post, never accepted Jesus during his life prior to crucifixion, converted only by the resurrection, which was convincing that a member of his family who thought he was crazy by the claims he made about himself converts because of the resurrection. But in the Middle Eastern concept that produced the Shiite branch of the Muslim faith, that a blood or near-blood relative is to succeed the spiritual leader, the Sunni appointed what they assumed to be the most spiritual man. The Shiites had a relative of Muhammad take charge. Same principle of the Middle East. Had James appointed the church at Jerusalem, and at the council when he lost in the arguments of Paul and Peter, he said, okay, Paul and Barnabas can go to the Gentiles. Peter and I will minister to the Jews. And you don't have to keep the whole law, but you got to keep the kosher part. And then he tags on, but remember the poor. That's the way the King James translates it. What's translated is the Ebionites, which was the name of the church in Jerusalem that prided themselves in being the poor. Now, coming out of the post-apostolic church, Christianity was emerging from the Jewish world. Judeo-Christianity still fashioned its solutions from images drawn from the Old Testament and the intertestamentary period, apocalyptic literature like the Book of Enoch and several apocryphal books. The Church of Jerusalem, with the death of James and then the invasion of Tatian and the destruction of the Church of Jerusalem, is still existing in the Middle East today as the Ebionites, subsequently called heretics, and that any heresy I would join in so naming, it'd be the Ebionites, who want to believe in Jesus as Messiah, but still make the trip to heaven, keeping the works of the Torah. They were subsequently called heretics. And here is so referenced, the heretical Ebionites of the second century insisted on the observance of Jewish law and custom. For them, and the issue of who Jesus really was began to emerge leading up to the Council at Nicaea. For them, Jesus was the elect of God and a true prophet. But they denied his virgin birth and eternal preexistence. And most scholars will recognize that the early Christians did not debate these philosophic questions. To them, those that were of the Jewish heritage already had a highly defined view of angelology and demonology. That was their solution to not departing from their monotheism, because the pagan religions had many gods and hierarchies of gods. They were monotheists, one God. So all these other powers embraced in the Old Testament plural word Elohim. Colossians speaks of angels present to deliver the Torah to Moses. They're called Elohim. And in the beginning, not El, Elohim said, let us make man in our image. To get around the possibility of multiplicity, they developed a very sophisticated hierarchy of angels and demons, angelology and demonology. And for the Ebionites, pursuing James's view, still Jewish, but accepting Christ as the Messiah. For them, Jesus was the elect of God and a true prophet, but they denied his virgin birth and eternal preexistence. The Son was created as one of the archangels who ruled over the other angels and over creatures of this world. This heavenly archangel descended upon Jesus the man. His primary mission in coming to earth was to end the Old Testament priesthood. Jesus earned his name of Christ by fulfilling the law, and the law, not Jesus, remained the true way to salvation. Now, this is a departure building out of James, who says, "Show me your faith, I'll show you my works." And they still exist today as a little legalistic Ebionite group in the Middle East. Judeo-Christianity as a cultural form went beyond the deficient theology of groups like the Ebionites and left its imprint, the use of Old Testament images to describe Christ, on many more orthodox Christian thinkers. A.D. 96, the author of The Mysterious Shepherd of Hermas, who wrote at Rome, adopts this terminology to his theology. The name of the Son of God is great and incomprehensible. It implies complete transcendence and preexistence of the invisible part of Jesus, the only begotten Son, who sustains the whole cosmos as the foundation and support of creatures who bear his name. The name is present too in Christians as a result of their baptism and confession of faith. The name of the Son of God is the only door, the only entrance to salvation for those who receive his name. Thus, with the use of the name, the author of the Shepherd of Hermas established a distinction within God and somewhat vaguely allowed the foundation of a Trinitarian, or at least a binarian belief. Yet God, not the Son, founded the church. It's God, not the Son, who comes in the last judgment. On he goes with his complicated angelology. "Have you seen," the shepherd asked, "the six men and the glorious great man in their midst? The glorious man is the Son of God, and those six are the glorious angels support him on the right and left." You understand why it didn't get into the canon. Then comes the Valentinians, who taught at Rome and Alexandria in the mid-second century. The Valentinians, I mean, this is going to bore the life out of me until I get to the funny guy. This is where the church went off. And this was the prelude to the councils, where men created God out of their own mind. The simplicity of the message of Paul went out the window. The simplicity of God moving into a tent of human flesh and declaring what no man had seen, but Christ led him forth and put him on display, as I preached this morning. Himself caused to be displayed. The Valentinians, listen to this. Mid-second century. They sought to resolve the ancient Greek problem of the one and the many. Began by postulating a supreme Father, unbegotten and perfect, who had by his side silence, the thought of the Father. From this primal couple, mind and truth, word and life, man and church, flow out successively by a process akin to that whereby thought proceeds from mind or desire from will. From this first group of eight proceeds in turn a group of 10, and then another 12, so that there are at least 30 divine entities or eons, half of whom are male, half female, forming the divine order of Pleroma and bridging the abyss between the single source and the realm of multiplicity. Can I hear an amen? But the loss of the 30 eons, wisdom, yearns illicitly to understand the Father and thus gives birth to desire. In order to rectify this primal disorder, mind and truth produce Christ and the Holy Spirit to instruct the eons about their proper relation to the Father. Formless desire, offspring of wisdom, meanwhile gives rise further to matter and psyche, whereupon Christ impresses form upon desire, who then gives rise to spirit or pneuma. Wisdom then proceeds to fashion the demiurge or creator, equivalent to God of the Old Testament, out of psychic substance. From matter and psyche, the demiurge forms heaven and earth and the creatures inhabiting it, which lets Marcion, the first great heretic, who thought that the only thing worth reading was Paul's letters and an edited Luke that takes the Jewish phrases out of it, and thought that the Old Testament, he wrote it off because the Demiurge was a lower God who created the Old Testament earth and activities and laid his law on people. This is what began to develop as we moved toward the third century. My Lord. I've heard preachers at times like that. Let me go to the next one. The second century heretic Marcion, who distinguished between the gods of the Old and New Testament. And then the Gnostics. And you have the Jesus Seminar equating the Gnostic literature found at Nag Hammadi. And we have a display down off the ladies' lounge where I've, in yellow markers, underlined the claims even in those Gnostic so-called sayings of Jesus, where he's making claims that no mortal man can make. We go through those who are fighting back and forth, and then I want to come to the adoptionist theory. Other currents within Christian theology would accept the one God of the Old Law and the Gospels, but would explain his relation to Jesus Christ in a different way. Still battling the attitude that you're naming Jesus as God, and that gets you out of the superior monotheistic view. So you've got to explain this connection in some way that still keeps you a monotheist. So the adoptionists come along. The adoptionists answered the question about Jesus by arguing that he was a mere man in whom God dwelt in a special way. Then on the other side were the monarchians, a general term for those who stress the unity of God in such a fashion that they acknowledged the divinity of Christ but denied his distinction from the fathers. The earliest adoptionists, of which we have records, seems to have been a second century shoemaker, a Byzantium teaching at Rome, Theodotus by name. For him, Jesus was merely man, though born of a virgin according to divine will. When Jesus was baptized in Jordan, he did not become God, but received the power to work miracles, for a spirit, the heavenly Christ, descended upon him and dwelt within him. The condemnation of Theodotus by Victor of Rome did not prevent one of his disciples, Theodotus the banker, from shoemaker to banker now, from alleging that Jesus was even inferior to Melchizedek, since the latter is fatherless, motherless, without genealogy, whose beginning and end is neither comprehended nor comprehensible. A far more troublesome advocate of adoptionism than these amateur lay theologians was Paul of Samosata, who was bishop of the great metropolis of the East, Antioch, in Syria, from 260 to 268. He seems, to say the least, to have been a bizarre sort of bishop. This is the funny one. Allied with Queen Zenobia of Palmyra, who controlled Antioch at this time. He went about, attended by a large group of bodyguards, consorted freely with unmarried women, preached to his tumultuous congregation while clapping his hands and stamping his feet from a high throne erected in his cathedral. He reasoned that the Word is from above, Jesus Christ is man from hence, Mary gave birth to a man like us, though better in every way, since he was of the Holy Spirit. Apparently he did not say that Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are one and the same, but gave the name God to the Father, that of Son to the mere man, and that of Holy Spirit to the grace which dwelt in the apostles. The second group of theologians would admit the divinity of Christ, but deny his distinction from the Father. This particular view afflicted the Church of Rome in the late 2nd and early 3rd centuries. That this was the view of Praxius, who taught at Rome, is known only through the writings against him of Tertullian, the North African bishop who played one of the most prominent roles in determining the canon at the later councils, what would be included as the divine word of God. It's been suggested that this Praxius that we meet in Tertullian's opposition, what's that 2 minutes for? What's that 2 minutes for? It's just 9 o'clock? Well, so what? I got till 9:23. I'm going to keep going. Okay, thank you for that warning. This praxeus, the name means busybody. And his suggestion that Tertullian was really writing about the Pope at Rome. And he creates this fictitious name, Praxeus. It has been suggested with some plausibility the name Praxeus, busybody, was Tertullian's pseudonym for Callistus, Bishop of Rome, who was, as we shall see, concerned to protect the divine unity. At any rate, said Tertullian, he is such a champion of one Lord, the Almighty, the Creator of the world, that he makes a heresy out of unity. He says that the Father himself came down into the Virgin, himself was born of her, himself suffered, and in short, himself is Jesus Christ. This view that the Father himself suffered on the cross earned for its advocates the title Patripassians. The Father was... Now, we have sex in America today, Jesus only. Any of you ever encountered the Jesus-only groups? From the 2nd and 3rd century on, people have forgot about the gospel, thought about, figured out, and failed to accept what Paul says, we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face, try to fathom God with our own brain instead of taking the simple message and learn that we're like blind men feeling the part of the elephant we encounter. And those who encounter the tail have a different view of an elephant than those who encounter the leg. And unwilling to humbly let eternity reveal the relationships, demanding allegiance to creed and performance to works, and that set the stage for the Council of Nicaea and the councils that followed that have dominated the church world for the last few centuries. I want to get back to the first century, folks, in the early second century before this started, when people were interested in one thing. What did Paul say as they translated into their various languages? And that's why we're doing what we're doing with these messages on Sunday as we go through Romans. He wrote it in 58 A.D. And he wasn't as concerned as these people are. And with his wonderful rhetorical skill, I'm quite sure he could have handled these doctrinal issues. But he was presenting the gospel, not philosophic ramblings of his own brain. I'll return after a song. We just went through another hour that I got a 2-minute warning on, and I have some other words to say, and then I'll introduce you to the morning service. But right now, I want you to get on the phone as they play the music, and some people just join us at 9 o'clock. We're in process, and I'm doing a little background teaching on church history to better prepare you for the message which follows in the next hour and a half, about 9:20, 20 minutes from now. So go on telephone as the music plays. Make your reservation for my big birthday Sunday. It's going to be not your regular service, but a party. My wife's going to surprise me with some things, and I can't wait, even though I don't like surprises. I'd like you to be one of the surprises by being there. Get on telephone. All right. No more calls. I said one song. I'm going to skip along in all these various things. The point I'm making is, for political reasons, a multitude of reasons, a confusion in that many of the Latin bishops and the Western bishops did not understand the possible understanding that was held in the East, that there's a difference between homoousios and ousios, or the difference between hypostasis and ousios, because the Latin word substantia means substance, as hypostasis does, but ousios has a little different existential and metaphysical meaning, and many of the Latin bishops couldn't read Greek, and so a lot of these councils turned on words, but more importantly on political power. I'm going to skip way ahead. As the second century continued to expand into these arguments about the true nature of Jesus in relationship to the Father, Arius moved on the scene. Arius, and you've heard of Arianism, that's the prelude to the controversy at the Council of Nicaea, and continued through at least two more councils. Arius, the theologian who brought Trinitarian speculation to the crisis stage and produced the current accepted non-heretical Trinitarian doctrine, which is logical nonsense. I can embrace it in faith, just like I can embrace some of these other things. Didn't know what they said, so yeah, I believe it. Didn't say anything. I believe they didn't say anything. You can't make sense in the English language of the Trinitarian or the Incarnation doctrine. They're paradoxical. And Lionel Niebuhr is the best discussion of some of these conflicts. But Arius, the theologian who brought Trinitarian speculation to the crisis stage, unless you think I'm a heretic, I helped write and rewrite the creed of the Assemblies of God. And the Nicene Creed is built in. I have no trouble with it. I just don't know what it means. I don't think anybody else does. It's an article of faith. Arius, the theologian who brought Trinitarian speculation to the crisis stage, was born in Libya, again, North Africa, as I said earlier, about 256. By 318, the date accepted by most scholars as opening the controversy, Arius was an elderly priest, tall, austere, aesthetically dressed, grim of countenance, urbane in manner. After having joined the schism of the Bishop Meletius against the legitimate line of bishops of Alexandria and Egypt, far drifted from the church founded by Mark, he was reconciled and given by Alexander the bishop the care of the fashionable church Bocchalis in the port district of the city. Here he was popular, especially with women, and was reputed to have had a following of some 700 consecrated virgins. All I do is smoke a cigar. The problem of tracing Arius' intellectual pedigree centers about our ignorance of the teachings of Lucian of Antioch, martyred in 312, under whom Arius studied. Fundamental to his system is the absolute transcendence and unicity of God, who is himself without source, but is the source of all reality. Since the very essence of God is transcendent, unique, and indivisible, it cannot be shared. For God to impart his substance to some other being would mean that he's divisible and changeable. Here we go on earlier. You remember I talked about some of these doctrines mutually contradictory and flowing out of Platonic, Hellenistic philosophy rather than the Bible, that God to be God cannot change, and therefore there's no duality. He's indivisible and changeable. There can, of course, be no duality in divine beings, for God's unique. Therefore, whatever else exists must come into being, not by communication of God's being, but by creation from nothing. Since the contingent world could not bear the direct impact of the all-powerful God, he needed an instrument of creation through which to mediate his power. This instrument is the Word, who is a creature, generated or made. These terms, synonymous for Arius, perfect beyond all other creatures, but a creature nonetheless, because he has a source, while God himself has none. The Word has a beginning, though born outside of time. Prior to his generation or creation, he did not exist. And if you're outside of time, how do you have a beginning? Just thought I'd throw that out. You know, outside of time, it's beyond our comprehension. But they had to define it. The Word has a beginning. The Arians would insist that there was when he was not. The Word can have no communication with, nor direct knowledge of God beyond that of other creatures. The titles of Word and Wisdom were his only because he shares in the essential reason and wisdom, God himself. The Word is liable to change and even to sin, though this last affirmation was modified to say that though he could sin, God foresaw his virtuous steadfastness and bestowed grace upon him in advance. Finally, wrote Arius, even if he's called God, Christ that is, he's not God truly, but by participation in grace. He is God in name only. What then is the nature of Jesus Christ? In Christ, the created Word, distinct from the Logos, reason immanent from God, united himself to a human body, lacking a rational soul, the Word himself taking the place of the rational element in the human composite. His teachings began to spread. By 320, Alexander the Bishop called a synod of the bishops of Egypt and Libya and excommunicated him. Arius fled to Caesarea in Palestine, where he was welcomed by the eloquent and erudite father of ecclesiastical history, Eusebius himself, who was strongly influenced by Origenist theology, with its insistence on three distinct hypostases within the Godhead. He then went from Nicomedia, enlisting others to follow him, and meanwhile from Alexandria, Alexander sent out the customary synodal letters to at least 70 bishops, informing them of the condemnation. The fight began to split that section of the empire, and with his victory over Licinius, Constantine became sole ruler of the Roman world, as I said earlier. Much to his distress, I like Constantine, listen to this, he found religious division within his politically unified realm. Thereupon he dispatched his chief ecclesiastical advisor, Osius, Bishop of Cordoba in Spain, who at 67 was a veteran in church politics, to Alexandria, armed with personal letters to Alexander and Arius, the combatants, who had returned to the city amid the political turmoil. Constantine was far from understanding, as his letters show, the significance of the controversy, as I am, a couple of idiots speculating. He reproached both Alexander and Arius for raising such questions at all. They were mere debating points arising from misused leisure, he said, results of intellectual exercises which should have been kept to oneself and not unadvisedly entrusted to the ears of the crowds. For he asked, who can comprehend or explain subjects so sublime and abstruse in their nature? Counseling mutual forgiveness, he advised the two that they were not really divided by any major doctrines or involved in any heretical opinions, but were actually of one and the same judgment, and so should join in communion and fellowship. He ended by warning them, for as long as you continue to contend about these small and very insignificant questions, I believe it indeed to be not merely unbecoming, but positively evil that so large a portion of God's people, which belongs to your jurisdiction, should be thus divided. I like Constantine. On his way back to Nicomedia, after Osias' attempts at reconciliation failed, he presided over a council at Antioch, which came out with the first bishop's creed, which I will skip over. All this was preliminary to the main bout. In 324, Constantine had called a council of all the bishops to meet at Ancyra. He now changed his venue to Nicaea, today the insignificant village of Iznik in Turkey. Nicaea, he said, was more accessible for the bishops of Italy and Europe and had a more congenial climate. Those things are important if you're going to listen to God. The city was also more accessible for the emperor, only 30 miles away at Nicomedia, his summer palace. Wherefore, said the emperor, I signify to you, my beloved brethren, that all of you promptly assemble at the said city. The battle was now well and truly joined. But before continuing the narration of the events of the council, it might be well to reflect for a moment on the fact that it was the emperor who summoned the bishops to the council. Only in the 7th and 8th centuries did the church try to clean that up and come up with a legend that Sylvester, Bishop of Rome, was responsible, although there may have been extensive discussions between the emperor and the principal bishops over the matter. Constantine thought he had the right to call a council because, quote, as quoted by Francis Dvornik, in there is said by him, in the spirit of the definition of Hellenistic royal competence, he regarded himself as legally entitled to interfere in religious affairs. He represented the divinity on earth. and was given by God supreme power in things material and spiritual. He thought it was his foremost duty to lead men to God. And after the council, Constantine wrote to the bishops, "As I discovered from the prosperous state of the Republic how great the divine power has been, I thought it my primary duty to bring it about that the saintly multitudes of the Catholic Church shall preserve one faith, a sincere charity, and profound reverence for the Almighty." Well, they had the council. And as Eusebius reports it, about May 20th, 325, as nearly as we can judge, the council was formally opened in the airy precincts of the imperial summer palace. The bishop ranged down each side of a large hall, stood expectantly silent, as the emperor, in purple and gold, entered with three members of the imperial family and a few senior advisors. He was, said Eusebius, who had previously been temporarily excommunicated until this council would finally determine it. But Eusebius was well liked by the emperor, so politics played an important part. And Eusebius quotes the scene or describes the scene. "It was," he said, "distinguished by piety and godly fear as the emperor came in, indicated by his downcast eyes, the blush on his face, and his gait. Proceeding to a low golden chair, he refused to sit until all the bishops had seated themselves. An unknown bishop on the emperor's right gave a speech of welcome. Constantine himself addressed the bishops in Latin, because of his imperfect Greek, or more likely, because Latin was the language prescribed even in the East for official state functions. I could take the time, but won't, to give you all of their arguments and the various debates and some of the stupid canons that came out of it. Six canons dealt with the dignity of the clergy. First canon forbade those who had castrated themselves to continue to minister. I mean, they were dealing with important subjects at this thing. And when it was finished, they gave two declarations, the second of which they ruled that Easter should be celebrated at the same time throughout the empire. The churches which observed Easter on Sunday after Passover, reckoned according to Jewish calculations, were ordered to observe the custom of Alexandria and Rome, where a different and non-Jewish cycle of calculation was employed. Unfortunately for the peace of the church, the bishops didn't realize that Alexandria and Rome themselves differed in their methods of calculation. The council finished its work August 25th, 20th anniversary of Constantine's elevation. And isn't it wonderful that this great council was called by the emperor, not a churchman, fighting over views politically of the nature of Christ, and Arius was excommunicated, and the fight began. Now, I think you understand a little better why I want to dig back past the second century and uncover the translations that had earlier documents than we have available to us today, with the wonderful collections that I've assembled, and in all these different languages. I think as you're listening and I'm dinning it in, you're beginning to understand there's a commonality in these early manuscripts that are helping to clarify what law he's talking about, what righteousness means, and what this unveiling of God's righteousness, as we move into the 22nd verse, consists of, as it begins with the pattern of the faith of Jesus. It doesn't begin with belief in Jesus. Now I'll get on the telephone, because I think we're close enough almost to the service. How many minutes before the service starts?
2 minutes, a minute and a half, sir.
A minute and a half?
A minute and a half.
Well, I can talk for a minute and a half before we go into the service. I thought I was going to be butter right up against it. I hope you understand. I had somebody call and say, I get confused sometimes, but before you finish, I start to get it. I'm going to stay with it until you can make your own decision. What, from all these different translations, what springs forth, indeed, as I use today in another context, what makes itself be seen as the truth of what Paul was proclaiming in the gospel? So we take you now, and I'll be right on time, they add something at the end. We take you now to this morning service in the cathedral. I hope you'll listen, and I hope that you'll get something that sets you free from the bondage that legalistic Christianity from these centuries onward has placed upon those that God's calling to the walk of faith.